The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
I guess I'll use this board because to study better later.
Okay, so the plan today is that we're going to talk a little bit about reading, which should feed directly into your thinking for the final assignment this class. We're going to play a couple of the games. There should be just enough games for everyone to get through one round. One play session, and the rest of the class today will be you to form teams and then talk in your teams and try to figure out what project that you're doing. Actually, the other way around. We're going to talk about projects and then you're going to form teams around them. So today's reading was entitled Simulation 101, right? It's literally 101. It's the very, very introductory, here's a bunch of terminology and a bunch of concepts about simulation. Has anyone read that before in any other class? Because I know it comes up in some other game design classes. Okay. So we have some sort of like source reality, right? Which I'm going to put question marks because, you know, we live in a postmodern world. And some sort of source reality where we are trying to create some sort of model. And then we've got something that we make as a simplified, abstracted version, which for now we're calling a simulation. Anyone remember what some of the things that simulations do that, well actually, what was the alternative to simulation that the article was talking about? How do we typically talk to people about, how do we usually convey an idea of this is how reality seems to work? What are some other ways that you do that?
You can abstract it.
Abstraction is a useful word, so I'm going to write it here, but you can do that to a bunch of different means. When Jane Austen tells you how life is like in, how was that, 18th century? Is that 18th century?
19th century. Huh? 19th.
It's early 19th?
Yep.
Okay. How is she doing it?
Metaphor.
Narrative.
She tells a story. She constructs a narrative. She does use some metaphors, but for the most part, it's just like very plain. This is what happened to these people, and everyone's upset. That was what the reading today says. Like, all right, you have this way of telling people about how something is. One way that you do it is you could tell a story about it. You could do a painting, some sort of visual version of it. You could create a little like physical sculpture of it if the concept is, if that's a good way to convey a concept, and create a simulation of it. He sort of lumps together things that sort of represent how the world works as a representation. It's sort of like a picture of a pipe is a representation of a pipe. It's not the actual pipe, but it's a visual representation as a narrative will be a sort of sequence of events, a sort of linear time representation of what happened. But it doesn't tell you anything about how that version of reality works. It doesn't, it may give you clues that you can sort of intuit, but it's not actually trying to show you how this thing behaves. And what we're trying to do with a simulation, because if in a broad sense you can think of simulation as a kind of representation, but very specifically, simulation is trying to tell you about how the system actually behaves. So if you're looking at some sort of reality, what are the kinds of things that you could be looking at? I mean, before you actually try to make some sort of working simulation about how reality works, what are some of the things that you want to look at? Let's be a little bit more concrete about this. If your reality is student debt. Okay, let's just say that's the system that we're looking at. We're looking at the world of student debt, and you're trying to create a model. If you wanted to explain to somebody else who doesn't really understand student debt, that this is, you know, these are all the things that you got to worry about. What are the things that you would try to that you might consider explaining to them? A high school student who's thinking, well, let's give an audience, a high school student who doesn't understand student debt but is thinking of applying to college. What would you tell them? What are some of the things you would want to tell them?
The situation under which student debt is accrued, what makes you accumulate?
Break it up a little bit more. What are some of the components of that?
Situations in which you need to take out loans or something.
Okay, situations, all right. Maybe cases, you know? This is sort of examples of things that tend to happen often. Okay, what else? Eventually, we're going to end up making games about this sort of thing. So if what would you want to know as a designer?
You want to tell them how they apply to get a loan and then how they pay it off eventually.
Okay. Those are kind of like mechanics, right? Those are kind of verbs. Like, how do I do that?
How to avoid having to take out loans?
Okay.
Getting scholarships and things instead, trying to work around it.
I will call those strategies. You have a range of different strategies, all of which to achieve the same goal, but some of them look better than others, and some of them you want to deliberately avoid. What else?
I'd say that any sort of maybe statistics on what usually happens would be helpful.
So probability of how often things happen? Okay. You're okay.
Talking about trends, student debt is increasing more than it has 10 years ago or something. The big picture of what it's looking like.
Okay, so that's like statistics, but from a more historical point of view, right? That would also include things like benchmarks, things to sort of compare yourself against.
The effects that having debt will have on a person or situations, I guess.
Sort of consequences?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, all right. Other things that I would include, would be things like variables. What are the numbers or little data points you're going to keep in your head? You need to be monitoring. That will tell you how the system works. So situations, cases, verbs, strategies. That's probably something I don't have a good word for it to explain how one thing affects something else. But that is kind of in consequences. So maybe flows, right? Where does the money go? What's the rate of money coming in from getting a student job versus getting a euro versus some other source of revenue, versus a loan, that sort of thing. And how does that affect how much money you have versus how much money you owe, that sort of thing. So you got all these things that come into the model. This out of reality, you create some sort of model that you understand. This is how you understand the world as it is. In a team project, this is how your team understands the world as it operates. And then you decide that you're going to make a simulation out of this, right? And you can choose what are the things that you want to bring over. I'm not going to go through that part of the exercise because everyone will have a different answer, but for some people, certain variables are going to be more important than other variables, depending on the kind of situation you want to make. If you want to play this game, I'm going to add rules as well, since that's really what our assignment is about. If you want to play this game as someone who is giving out loans, then the verbs and the variables and the cases that you're thinking of are going to be very different. You're going to be thinking about giving out loans to large numbers of students. Whereas if you're playing this game as a student, then the simulation is meant to simulate what the world looks like from the point of student, then what's happening to somebody else doesn't really matter all that much to you. You really just care about yourself. And so the variables that you care about are going to be different. How those things affect your life are going to be different. Now, there is this step to abstraction. And correct me if I'm wrong, Rick, I think that's where Jason Biggie puts the simulation gap.
Yes.
Yeah. That's this thing where not only do you decide that there's a bunch of things in here that you're going to choose not to bring over to your simulation or choose to bring over to your simulation, then you can also think of a way to sort of further simplify that. Right? Maybe we're not going to, you know, maybe certain kinds of consequences from interest, from loans or whatever, normally increase in some sort of like non-linear scale. But for the sake of making a simpler simulation, we're going to assume that it's linear. We're going to say, you know, that every time you, every turn, the amount of debt that you have increases by a fixed amount rather than, you know, percentage or something like that, instead of just compounding the interest. Because that simplifies things, but maybe still gets certain points across. This thing down here, some people call a simulation gap. Other people sometimes place it over here. But Lazada Frasca makes a case that this has to happen. No matter what you do, you have to do this because you're never going to be able to fully simulate everything that you already that you know, and besides, you don't know everything about reality anyway. So this has to happen. But there is a design choice that you make over here of what you want to simulate and to what fidelity you want to simulate it. For instance, one of the games that we have today is Koleka, which is, again, standing in queues, waiting for rationed goods to come in while living in 1980s communist Poland. You have no idea when the next truck of goods is going to show up. Now, the reality is that there are schedules. Even in communist Poland, people actually, there was a schedule in which objects were supposed to show up in certain stores. I believe that's actually an action that hints at that, but all it does is that basically it allows you to place a desired object in one of the stores at will, and it's a special thing that you have it. But for the sake of the abstracted version of the game, which they've made, they're going to say, when you were, as someone who was living at that time, yes, there were schedules. There was possible to actually figure out when certain goods were going to be show up to some reasonable level of accuracy, but the majority of people who were involved in the system had no access to that. And so for the most part, it was random. And that's a decision that they're making, that's a point they're trying to get across. Now, whether that's true or not, that's something that the designers want to convey through the design of the game. That's something that you can also decide. If there's a point that you want to make across, a lot of the rhetorical points are going to be right here. So if you want to say, we had a game last year which was about people cross-dressing to get into the French theater. Not all of them were cross-dressing. Some of them were dressing up, some of them were dressing down for various reasons of social class and trying to get a cheaper ticket and being able to get into parts of the theater that you otherwise couldn't and things like that. It wasn't explicitly a simulation, but they were trying to get across a point that this is the sort of thing that you can do. Everybody had it. If your mind was, I want to get into the theater, there were multiple ways you could get into the theater, and there were different reasons for every single person. So a noble woman might cross-dress as a man in order to be able to get a cheaper ticket and basically go slumming with the people buying the cheap tickets because it's a lot more exciting down there. Somebody who is in the clergy, you know, will have to cross-dress. Will also cross-dress to be able to buy a ticket as a woman because clergy aren't supposed to be going to theater. So they're disguising themselves for other reasons, even though they actually create a more visible position. And there's a lot of bartering. There's a lot of thievery of like various hair pieces and clothes and stuff like that. It's pretty fun game. I'm actually just going to grab that and bring it over. So when we play the games today, I want you to think a little bit about the situation they're trying to respond. The Gentleman of the South Sandwich Islands is a game about crossing bridges. If you've ever done any classes here in MIT or high school about bridge crossing theories, that game is all about that, but it's ostensibly a game about matchmaking, or finding a match, I guess. And you're sort of chasing where the men are chasing the women, who are also being chased by their
chaperones.
Yes, we figured this out last week. So you know that's a very very that's skipping the whole like actual dialogue with the gentlemen and the ladies there. They're just making it this traveling game. And you can ask yourself, what are they trying to get across? Whether intentional or not, you know, doesn't really matter. But the game sends a message about how this system is supposed to work that you can take away as somebody who's played the game. Same thing for Kaleika, same thing for Tulip Mania, which is again about a bubble economy, about Crunch, which is also about a bubble economy, only a lot more recent. As Crunch in particular wears its heart on its sleeve, it's trying to be a satirical thing, a commentary about how big banks seem to be operating. Whether or not that's actually how they operate is kind of beside the point. But they do have certain elements of simulation in there, and then they just abstract to make you focus on the things that you want to focus on, that they want you to focus on. So, let's see. Two of those games are two-player games, so that's only going to account for four people in this classroom. The other two go up to five players, so we can probably split everybody else into groups of about four, I think. 12 people, so groups of four. That should make the games go in a pretty good clip. Crunch and Gentlemen of South Sandwich Islands are pretty fast compared to the other two games, so the people who are playing those games might want to switch games and play each other's games after that. It'll probably be a lot faster if the people who've just completed a round then turns around and explains it to the next group, because then they won't have to read the rules, although again, it's not that long. So let's do that for about an hour, yeah. Especially Kaleika takes about an hour. And after that, we'll talk about class. Okay? We'll talk about assignment. So, any questions about this? No? All right. Make sure you talk with your teams about this, especially when you're looking at how the rules work, but also while you're playing the game. I've talked to both the team that played Tulip Mania, or not the team, but the group that played Tulip Mania and the group that play Kaleika. I haven't had a chance to talk to the folks who play Crunch and the Gentlemen of the South Sandwich Islands yet. So let's talk a little bit about...
I have cards on my body that I would like to get rid of if we're done. Yes.
I don't want to call it. We're still in, so we can all get.
Okay, I'm going to say the game's on pause. Okay, but I do want to talk a little bit about not so much how this one particular game is being played out, but rather what does this game render in very high detail, and what does it sort of gloss over in very low level granularity. So what's like very very well rendered in this game in the opinion of people who played the game.
I would say corruption.
Yeah.
Also, there's a lot of, like, for example, when you're, like, sneaking a card, like, you kind of wonder if someone's watching you, and I think that's actually, like, pretty similar in the real world, too, like, with a corrupt CEO. You kind of wonder if someone's, like, going back and checking your records, if you can actually get away with, like, taking this money and storing it somewhere.
Right.
Well, one thing is that they can, that's not quite, I wouldn't quite agree, because in this game, they can see the number of cards in your hand going down, and as long as they don't see you actually putting them away, they're like, you're clearly embezzling, I can't do anything about it. So
there is on one hand the I don't want to get caught in the act of embezzling, but on the other hand the very clear assumption that everybody is, right? And it's like you can see it's happening, you know that it's going around, that everybody in the game is engaging in this, but you don't. The only thing that you're worried about is just be caught in the act of having your hand in a kitty. But it's okay that that the cookie jar seems to be emptier than normal. and the game does that well. But what's really sort of vague, like deliberately vaguely represented in the game?
Like all the actual like bank sort of mechanics. So it's
mostly there.
Can you give me an example?
I like the whole like investing on assets thing. It's like a pretty good, it's probably a pretty good like simplified version of it for the game, which is fine because that's not the main focus of the game. It's not like to make smart investment choices. It's to embezzle things. So.
So the odd thing about it is that the actual operation of the banks is remarkably trivial.
Yeah.
Right.
Or it's been trivialized to the point of, like, that's the point of this game is not how to run a good bank.
Yeah.
I also don't know how this works in the real world, but, like, the government bailouts in this game seem like just kind of like candy, basically. Like, you just, oh, I want a government bailout. Oh, okay. Government bailout. Sure. You need a government bailout. Like,
I don't like it.
Wait, that's
yeah,
just like the real world.
Is it,
yeah, that is sort of.
Financial crisis and all the banks were failing, like the auto manufacturers started asking the government for money.
They got jack.
They got a lot.
Some of them did.
Some of them
did. So like Ford decided they didn't need it, but like, GM got a ton of money.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
so sometimes
kind of
I
like,
do it. Yeah.
But
and again, it's a deliberate choice, right? I mean, it's like I think what you're saying is that yeah, it's ridiculously trivial to get a government bailout, and it's clearly designed to be to make you think that yeah, the government is just gonna come in and take care of this, right? You know, even though I'm in a hole of like several $50 million or something, you know, it's like yeah, the government will take care of it. So you know, I've had a similar discussion with all of the other teams. How you know, Tulip Mania and Coleco, what are the things that are like really in high resolution? You know, everything that you can possibly do in that, in standing in line, you know, is what the entire game is about, right? Whereas things about like money, for instance, are oddly enough the way how the black market played out in the. In Colega was less in the mind of the group that was playing apparently because everybody had stuff to do and you didn't really have to stand in line, but that might have changed with a smaller number of people. And Tulip Mania, let's see what did we talk about the stuff that was really in high resolution.
It was the broker, right? Trying to encourage the buyers, or using buyers to drive prices up.
Right. So the whole of like getting other people who have money, who aren't even playing the game. These are NPCs. These are non-player characters. To put money down on the investments that you're telling them to make. You know, it's really what that whole game's about. And just one detail for how that works. It's all about that speculative activity. Whereas things like the actual prices and like when the bubble decides to burst and things like that, those things are simplified to the point where you know the players can make a decision about it in a way that maybe real people can't make a decision quite so easily. Okay, so hopefully that gives you some ideas and about you know the way how you can sort of and you can play around with the level of fidelity in your game. And now we're already you know down to our last half hour in class. So let's talk a little bit about your assignment three. I mean, first of all, if anyone's been thinking about this, I know you guys want to get back to it. If anyone's got an idea for assignment three that you want to like pitch to your team to the class now to be able to form a team, now is probably a good time to do it. You know, it doesn't need to be fully fleshed out. I mean, pick your hand.
So I have an idea for a first war game based around the first triumvirate, where their players are like Caesar and Pompey and Crassus, and.
The Roman triumvirate.
What the Roman triumvirate? And basically, all the players sort of these three players want to all sort of want to march on Rome, become dictator there. But like, there's the other two players sort of standing in the way, and also like sort of the Roman establishment that like doesn't like their own setup, which doesn't want a dictator. And so you are trying to through campaigns acquire like loyalty to your soldiers and more influence in Rome, so that you can eventually overcome this. You're also sort of pushing your luck and sort of making like taking riskier plays. So you can do this sort of faster than the other players. Eventually, someone gets far ahead enough, or someone's risk doesn't pay off and they get killed, and then the whole thing, then the balance is thrown off and the players start fighting each other.
So it's kind of like tenuous cooperation.
Yes.
So it's an certainly a lot, a wealth of material to look at when it comes to the fall of the Roman Republic. Basically, like these are if anyone points to people who like individual people who caused the fall of the Republic and turned into dictatorship, it'd be these three people. obviously, it's the fall of just three, but that might be, you know, if you're interested, or if you don't actually know all that much about ancient Rome and would like to, that's probably a good project to get into, because I can't think of many better ways to learn about a topic that interests you than to try to make a game about it. Anybody else?
So this isn't like a complete idea at all, but I'm probably coming about it from the wrong direction. But I would be very interested in finding some historical event where the person like consistently felt that like things were out of their control and like sort of kept getting pushed in the same direction, and make it so that the game always does the same, like always ends in the same way, so there's like it's a deterministic game apart from sort of like certain how you get there in the middle. So like make it so that, say for example, like one of the two players, like if there's two players, like one of them is like guaranteed to be the winner. So like make it actually follow history, and then don't tell people this, and just have the game where like eventually people realize that like this is a game where the like, hey, this playthrough turned out remarkably like actual history. And then like they play it again, and it's still remarkably like actual history. And then like eventually you can realize that you're playing through the motions, you know, like actually making.
You could subtly make a game where the sort of governing forces are very powerful. So it's going to be playing out in pretty much the same way each time. But then the question is, what's the agency that you have in there, right? What decisions do you get to make to be able to influence things? So even a game like Twilight Struggle is not a great example of this, but it's a game that's based on real events that are actually in a deck of cards. And so when they play out, these are things that actually happened in real history, you know, and they may not play out in necessarily right order, but they will always happen, and you're sort of like seeing what were kinds of decisions you had to make in all of those circumstances, you know. Even though maybe you went into those circumstances with slightly different parameters.
Most operational level war games do exactly that.
Mm.
It's the game is not about getting the Germans to win or winning Vietnam. It's more about what are the various strategies you had to use at the time. But more than likely, though, the game is set to end the way history had played out. They're really complicated games. There's some less complicated ones. So if you end up going down that route, I might have some card-based versions of the games to kind of help show.
You might also want to like zoom in into like a very, very, it's sort of a wide swath of history, but it's like small, specific chunk.
Most war games about battles will allow you to have the battle end in a different way, but anything that's like operational level tends to be very much about just exploring what it was like to be in that situation.
That's true, yeah, I didn't think about that. Yeah. So you'll have your hand up forever, and then we'll go back this way.
I have a separate idea, but just for that specific idea, something that popped into my mind was like maybe the Russian Revolution, where like everybody's just kind of caught up in like all this craziness. And so like the game is basically forcing you that your revolution is going to lose and another one's going to come in. But like along the way, you like try and set up your like perfect state or whatever.
You could imagine a game where there's already this tidal wave of change happening.
Yeah.
You don't stop the wave, but how well can you ride that wave?
Yeah.
Right.
But an idea I was thinking about was the dot-com bubble back in like the late 90s, where basically you would be some startup with a ridiculous business plan who's trying to basically acquire as many users as you can in a short amount of time, like IPO, get a lot of money from VCs, and then sort of like, you know, get out before everything crashes. So I guess about a bubble like Tulip Mania is, but a little different in terms of the mechanics of like how you deal with the bubble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. For that one, think about what the people who are going through that, what did they actually know about the bubble? Did they know the bubble was going to happen or not? At least for this assignment.
Yeah.
It's about being in the perspective of the person at that time, in that real time.
Okay.
So what amount of it is hindsight versus what they actually thought of at the time?
Okay.
Yeah. It's easy to make a game. I mean, we've had games in this class that were also about dot-com bubble, but a lot of it was the kind of like making fun of how ridiculous it looks like now in hindsight.
Uh-huh.
But it's good to try to sort of like what information did they have at that time? It looked like, you know, did this look like it was going to go on forever, you know?
Okay.
I have like three sort of ideas, I guess. My most solid one, I think, is I want to make like a two-player game where one is one person is in a position of power,
mm-hmm.
and the other person is like working for them or otherwise subversive to them. And that the person in the position of power has the ability to like is oppressing the other person, and what the other person can do, like to sort of like should they try to overthrow them, like does this, you know, how does this affect their life? That sort of play of power there.
Mm-hmm.
And another idea I had was sort of like a love affair thing, which is a three-player game, and like I'm not sure beyond that, a three-player game with like love affair or something.
It might be easier to identify a specific,
yeah.
you know, three,
yeah, exactly.
three people in this.
Yeah,
group.
Maybe like Yoko and all the Beatles.
Yeah. That would be awesome.
Yeah. So yeah, something like that. And then another one, which I want to do less than the other two, but like a game about like feminist factions and how like they're all like technically fighting for the same thing, but they argue over these minor points. So it'd be like four feminist factions.
So I think locating that in time, because you know, will be important.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. So I had sort of two vague ideas. First one is I'm really interested in technology that changes the way people live their everyday lives. So taking a look at the 20th century, we had personal computers. So it could be like you're trying to hack things together in garages in Silicon Valley in the 1970s. That's one idea. Another idea is like being Henry Ford and like building cars or bringing cars to the masses for the first time. Maybe you're like a plant, like overseer, and you're like building up an assembly line or something like that. Or another one could be like doing through the Wright brothers, inventing the airplane, so it could be like an experimental game. So, and then another idea I had was you're like in the 1500s or 1600s and you're a merchant, you've got your ship, and you need to like go buy stuff and bring it home and sell it. But the complication is there, you know how like those old-timey maps had sea monsters all over them because, you know, ships would disappear and
mm-hmm.
must be a sea monster that ate the ship because like our tech was really good back then, right? So that was like the only rational explanation. So I was thinking, like, Jory helped me flesh this site. What's that?
It's also the edge of the map.
When you go off the Earth.
Yeah, going off the Earth.
But this is after 1492.
What's that?
This is after they've established the world is actually around. But there could be monsters
okay.
in there.
Yeah. So there's like two islands, or like there's Europe and Africa or something, where like here's your home, and like here's the place where all the resources are, and you have to like get to the resources and back. But there's a sea monster in the middle, so maybe it's like a path-building game where there's some random aspect to the sea monster, and if it eats you, you're dead. But if you can survive it, maybe you'll profit.
So you're a ship captain.
You're like a merchant ship captain.
Okay. Anyone has a had a chance to say who had their hands up yet? Okay, you can go.
I'd like to not say something about that, but just it's part of the kind of different idea, which is what if you're the person, the map maker, and you're getting data on which ships are disappearing, and you're trying to figure out where the monsters are on the map. So you're getting this like information about like this. So you have to like make the sort of maybe if like you could really make it obvious that that's not actually what's going on by like rolling dice or something for like whether or like doing something like very clearly random for whether a particular like which ships out of a particular set come back and which don't based on like where they were going. and then somehow maybe you're supposed to like really make your case that like this is exactly where the monsters are, and like my map matches the data, and like these other players' maps don't.
So you want to be looking
at
cartography technology that was up there, or you know, what seagoing timepieces look like at that time, navigation, but also how their societies of information ran at the time. Like, was it all just like the Royal Society of blah, or was it more entrepreneurial?
Yeah, so for that one, like possible primary sources, if you wanted to keep the fantastical element, but still make it a little bit more realistic at the time, Umberto Eco wrote a book, Bottolino, about the mystery of Prester John, the Presbyter John who went from Europe to bring Christianity to
Japan?
Or was it the Orient? But it's a book about the Orient. It's a book about map making, cartography, that kind of knowledge sharing, and the idea that if you just say something existed, it existed for real. Enough people believed it. The people in power believed it, so that it might as well have been real. And that's the kind of that's the weird kind of world they were working in like the 13th and 14th century in Europe. Is that you'd have these itinerants come around, say, yes, I met Prester John, here's his map, and by the way, here's a relic of Jesus, or here's a relic of some other saint. And just by saying that, gave those objects power, it gave that person power, at least for a short little while, within that little burg that he was traveling through.
Well, I was also going to suggest like a cartography kind of game where you're an explorer trying to map out something.
So, map making before modern technology is clearly a theme that one or two teams could pursue. Anybody else has ideas? It doesn't necessarily need to be game mechanic ideas. It could be just time period and person ideas.
Well, so I don't know if I want to do this or not because it's kind of really controversial. But I'm from North Dakota, and we. Like, I don't know, I've seen a lot of the Native Americans, like, struggle, and, like, I've read a lot of their history. And so I was thinking about making, like, a satire on, like, one person's the Native Americans and one person's the United States, and, like, just to illustrate the crazy injustices. But also that's kind of heavy. I don't know if I want to explore it, but, yeah, like, the ridiculous things that happen.
Well, it's not that far off from some of the ideas you had about like two very different levels of power, right?
Yeah.
And in that case, also two very different levels of access to information.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, maybe you should talk with them to see if those ideas work out.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Not really fleshed out, but I was thinking about looking at a mass murder in history.
Okay.
Just any one of them, trying to make a game off of
it. Okay, so I mean, there are mass murders on the scale of armed conflict, you know, armed public conflict, you know, and then there's mass murders of the serial killer sort, where it's a mystery kind of thing. Do you have a preference?
Thinking serial killer.
Okay, all right. There's a couple of famous ones. And what sort of roles, like the investigation part of it, or the trying to get away with it kind of thing?
I think they're trying to get away with it.
Right.
You might get visited by the FBI.
people watch the Meet the Team videos for Team Fortress 2. So one of these videos is about the Pyro, who's one of the characters. And in that video, it shows the Pyro's worldview as sort of like Candyland, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a guy who like goes around and burns everything. And I'm thinking maybe something, just in response to what you're saying about a mass murderer, if you can find some mass murderer who is like historically known to be crazy, and then you can have two different boards, the way that there were for like the Thief game, with the last project, and you can have one of the boards be like very clearly like fantasy land, and like this guy's going after like something, he's like trying to find some, like I don't know, like trying to give gifts to women or something, right? And he's going like going around slaughtering them, and on the other map it's like the sort of real view of what's happening there, and so you can have like whoever's opposing him, whoever's trying to stop him,
sees a completely different view on the situation.
So kind of similarly related to that idea, like a good example, forget what the name was, I think his name was Holmes, but it's like kind of, if you read, like, there's a book called Devil in the White City, and it's basically about how, like, at the Chicago World's Fair, like, there was, you know, they're building this, like, beautiful city, like, to, you know, show off to the world, like, what America could do, and there was all this, like, innovation, and, you know, like showing off like the electric lights and how exciting that was and all these different things, and like they built this like these beautiful like huge white buildings and like they set up this whole thing, and then like in like the shadow of this there was like this serial killer who was like exploiting the fact that there were like migrant workers there all the time trying to build this to like help obfuscate his like very criminal activity. So
That's a great way, and it also keeps it in the spirit of the assignment too. Is thinking about you've got this new situation, you've got these new systems involved, and how are you exploiting these systems in various ways? For anything serial killer, I'd be really really cautious about the, and actually, and even with the Native American aspect or any kind of like system of oppression, be really cautious about how you're representing the oppressed, the person being oppressed.
Mm.
If you're putting it like. If you're putting it in the point of view of the oppressor, just be really, really careful about that. It's actually, I just personally think it's more interesting to be in the point of view of the person being oppressed,
mm-hmm.
and how they're responding to that situation.
Mm-hmm. That's a quote by Brenda Brathwaite, who has done a couple of games on systemic oppression, that every time there, if you look at any historical case of human, well, not case, period of human oppression, you can always find a system underneath it. That system that actually enables people to be more easily inhumane to each other. And of course, as game designers, systems are very attractive to us, and we can look at that. But yeah, you know, just be aware that you're not exploiting the history of people who are, you know, who were oppressed one way by taking their culture away from them. Right? Try to do it in some respect. Try to bring some empathy into it. You know, into like this is what it was like. You know, and the limits that they had on the kinds of decisions that they could make, for instance.
So a lot of people, like, I don't think I have any like really good historical games that are like very asymmetric. Mm-hmm. Or the ones that are, I mean, very complex, right? I don't have any simple historical games that are like, that are good, but that are asymmetric, sort of. So with, basically, all the historical games I know that are both good and simple are like symmetric. You don't have sort of these imbalances in power between the players, because that requires like having very complicated different rules to make sure that like it works and then it works in like the necessary way.
It is a huge design challenge for sure. It's not going to be easy.
Isn't Brenda's Irish game asymmetric?
Yeah. Well, I mean that's an example. That's an interesting game because so there's a game Brenda Brathwaite, now Brenda Romero, is a designer of many many famous computer games, including like the Wizardry series all the way back in the 80s. But what she's more often known for nowadays is a series of games that she designed for museums on various systems of historical human oppression, the Trail of Tears.
She did Train.
She did a game about the English occupation of Ireland, basically. The way how that game dealt with it is that all the players are symmetric. All the players are different Irish families. But the system is playing against you. The system is basically this mechanical influx of the English taking up more and more Irish land and cramming all of the Irish into smaller and smaller amounts of land, and people get pushed off the island into, you know, forced immigration, basically. But that's another way to approach it, right? You know, it's like it's asymmetric, but in a way that's easier to design because it's the game system versus the players. And the game system's actually, in that game, the game system is forcing the players into conflict with each other because there's less and less resources for more and more people. In a small space.
I'm trying to think. I never
played the other games.
You're right. Like all the card-based two-player games that GMT puts out, like Twilight Struggle, there's a lot of really complex, there's a lot of complex things going on underneath, and a lot of it's buried in the cards itself. But the, then yeah.
Well, I can think of games that are like highly asymmetric, but not incredibly complicated, and a lot of it, the games like Cosmic Encounter, for instance, which is not historically based whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about alien races, you know, and each alien race basically has a rule they can break in a very, very interesting way. But everybody starts with the same pool of rules, plus this one thing that they get to break.
Yeah.
Tammany Hall, which we didn't get a chance to play today, is another one where it largely comes down to every round that you play in that game, there is a particular rule that you can break because you are occupying a position in city government. You can think of it as a rule that can break or a special ability you can execute. That's another way to be able to think about it, right? We've already had like the thief game, which was really more like, is, you know, two different games that you're being played, that are being played simultaneously. So if any of you have were involved in that team, you already have a perspective on what it's like to be able to design a game with asymmetric information, but asymmetric abilities as well, and different goals. You know, it's been done in this class before. It is a design challenge, but you can do it.
The original Netrunner is still a little complicated in that, yeah, there's a ton of different of cards that are bearing a lot of the stuff. But
once you're
it's closer to what you can do in this class period.
As long as you have a game that has different goals, you're already introducing a symmetry.
I want to say that, like, yeah, you said Cosmic Encounters, pretty symmetric, but it's not balanced at all.
No, it's not. It doesn't need to be. That's not a requirement of this class. This class is something playable and engaging. I never asked for a balance game.
Bless you.
I mean, this is first of all, the time frame that we're giving you to finish these games is a little bit unrealistic for balance. But
iteration.
Usability will be nice.
Iteration, so it gets more balanced as time passes. Yes.
Yes.
But at the end, we still don't. We're not great. We're not really grading on balance so much as we're grading on iteration and
things like
design
like, like usability is going to be something that we are going to look at. Do I understand your rules is more important than how well do your rules work. If your rules, of course, completely break, that's a problem. But if your numbers are off by, you know, a few percentage points or a couple of off integers, even, but I still understand how your rules work, that means a lot more to me.
Just throwing an idea out there, the role would be one of the people who were really kind of founded the board game industry.
Mm-hmm. You mean like the Parker brothers?
Maybe. So like from the perspective of a game designer or of someone who's really like trying to make this business a business.
And you could be something like, you know, a Hasbro that's just trying to eat other people's businesses, you know, or you can be something like the independent boutique brands that are trying to make a name for yourself.
I figured that'll be close to people's hearts here.
Yeah, you still have to do a lot of research, because we obviously haven't covered a lot of them in this class. But it'll be interesting research. And it kind of fit in nicely with the sort of time period that John was talking about, the 20th century, the mass productization of America kind of thing. But also, you probably do need to limit that to one country's industry. America is probably easier to do it. It's a bit difficult to look at the whole world. Okay, bunch of ideas out here. Team, the rest of the class today, I know this group wants to get back to the game, you can do it, but time for you to talk around with your ideas.
Feel free to email your ideas to the game design mailing list. If you need to find other people, we'll do this again at the end of day, Wednesday, right?
Wednesday.
And then teams should be formed by Monday, because on Wednesday the 16th, that's the first presentation. Is that right?
Yeah, the first pitch.
The pitch. So, as a reminder in that, we want to know about what primary and secondary sources you're using as your inspiration, what kind of game you think you might be making. If you're nothing set in stone, it's much more of a, give us a pitch of why this game idea is interesting, and what is the source of information you're using to make sure that the game is realistic.
Let me make sure that we get that. There's April 14th is when, oh, the April 16th is when you do the pitch part of it.
Yeah.
On April 14th, you should already be able to talk a little bit about, this is the idea that we wanted to work with. These are the people in my group. These are some of the sources of information that we're looking at. Because we'll have guests, and they'll be able to give you some feedback on that. Both in the pitch and in the guest visit, we're not actually so much grading you on the quality of your pitch, but we are going to provide you feedback on how you're pitching, so that if you have to do pitching in real life, in your career, after graduation, you can get some feedback on how you presented yourself. All right, cool.
It's my turn.